Welcome back to University of Minnesota Extension's Nutrient Management Podcast. I'm your host, Paul McDivitt, Communications Specialist here at U of M Extension. This is part two of our special episode on what happens to soil and nutrients after they leave the field, with Extension Educator Greg Klinger and Kevin Keener from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. If you haven't listened to part one, be sure to give that a listen. Let's jump right back into the discussion.
Kevin, I want to hear about... You know, we've talked about what's happening at the edge of field scale and these small streams that are feeding into the larger river watershed in terms of nutrient losses. We talked about that. I want to hear about soil and nutrient losses in the river. But before we do that, I think it's worth having a little conversation, take a quick detour and talk about sediment fingerprinting. And I think in order to really do that justice, we need to talk about what I'd call the unanticipated consequences of nuclear testing. So when you think about the United States started doing nuclear bomb testing in Southwest U.S. in 1945. When a bomb was detonated, it produces all these radioactive isotopes that previously didn't really exist in nature. For example, you know, the energy of that blast produces like radioactive cesium or strontium or plutonium that are just slightly different from the cesium or strontium that are naturally occurring. And then you have actually machines out there that can physically observe those differences and separate out those radioactive strontium, for instance, from the non-radioactive version. So you got that sort of situation. So you go back to 1945, they start testing bombs in the desert. Every time one detonates, you know, releases a huge amount of dust in the atmosphere, right? With all these radioactive isotopes in it. And that dust travels all over the globe. It comes down in raindrops or just as dust pretty much everywhere across the globe to some extent onto the land surface. So soils everywhere around the world at this point in time, you know, 1945 and later, have small amounts of this radioactive dust in them. And since you can measure that radioactive isotopes, you can do a simple presence-absence test. You know, if you take a sample of soil or groundwater or whatever it is, and it has no radioactive, say, cesium in it, then you know it wasn't at or near the land surface in 1945 or later when we started doing above-ground nuclear testing. But you can also go further than that to get more information. I think it's pretty interesting because all these different radioactive isotopes, they break down over time, right? Some will be gone mostly within 20 or 30 years. Some it takes, you know, 500 years or 1,000 years, and some it's going to be 10 million years, you know, way beyond the scope of our, you know, really understanding. And some of them also, they move downward through the soil profile, or some just, they tightly absorb to that topsoil, just like the top 2 or 3 centimeters, you know, right at the land surface. So what's interesting is that if you go around taking soil samples, because of these different properties of these radioactive isotopes, you could take samples from different types of landscapes, you know, like a cultivated field, a whole bunch of them, pastures, forests, marshy floodplains, whatever it is. And you then measure the radioactive isotopes from those areas, you start to see some patterns. In other words, because the topsoil is basically mixing in different ways, you know, when you cultivate land versus a hillside forest versus a floodplain, all the samples from the cultivated fields are going to look more similar in terms of these radioactive isotopes to each other than they look to like a forest or a floodplain, and vice versa. So you basically get a profile or a fingerprint for different land use types. And then if you start taking water samples from, say, the Root River, and you filter out all the water and just trap all the soil that's in it, you can measure the radioactive isotopes in it, you can tie it back to the soil fingerprints, and you can get a sense of not only where did that soil come from, but when was it at the land surface. And I hope that's a pretty reasonable synopsis, but there's a study that basically did that exact thing for the Root River. And I'm wondering if you can just walk us through what that study found in terms of where soil in the Root River was coming from.
Yeah, so it was really unique with this project that we had both edge of field data, we had the data coming from these small watersheds, but we also had data from the outlet of the Root River watershed, and that's data from the Pollution Control Agency, and they have a network of what they call pollutant load monitoring sites throughout the state. And it was early in the study, it was about within probably the first few years, that we started noticing that we saw these larger reductions at the watershed scale, but even like I mentioned earlier, we would expect that the sediment reductions would be even more at the outlet of the watershed because of scale. As we work up in scale, we should have more opportunities for sediment reduction because more opportunities to get the sediment to get settled out. But the initial data was showing us we weren't really seeing much change in the sediment and phosphorus levels coming out of the watershed. So there, what was happening there, and it kind of lends to your point in terms of where is that sediment coming from in the root, because we know that it's not just field sources that we're measuring at the outlet of the Root River watershed, which is near Mound Prairie. And at that scale, it's about a million acres, a little over a million acres in size. And so the question becomes, where is that sediment coming from? And that's sounds like a simple question, but it's obviously a very complex one in terms of all the potential complexities that are happening at that watershed level. So we partnered with a researcher, Patrick Belmont, and a variety of his other researchers that he works with. And he was able to conduct a study. It was a five-year study to actually try and identify those sources. And what was really cool about the project and very unique was that he was not only using the sediment fingerprinting that you're alluding to, but he was also using other lines of evidence. And those other lines of evidence would actually be physical measurements of the amount of sediment stored within the floodplain of the Root River. And they're actually taking hundreds of physical measurements of soil cores within the floodplains, and then they're actually mapping a lot of those floodplains using LIDAR and other technologies to help quantify the actual total amount of sediment. And that was kind of one line of evidence that they used, and then they also used this sediment fingerprinting. And like you mentioned, the isotopes that they're using is they actually use three different isotopes. One was cesium-137, which is a result of the nuclear testing follow-up from the 1940s and 50s from that the testing that occurred at that time. The other one was a lead-210, which is a byproduct of uranium, and that's a naturally occurring isotope that occurs within our soil. And through the process, it actually gets emitted as radon gas and then becomes lead-210 in the atmosphere and then is deposited on the soil surface. And then beryllium is the other one, and that's actually more through cosmic rays that falls on our through precipitation, and that isotope adsorbs to the soil. And like you mentioned, it has a unique signature to it. And from that, these researchers can estimate where that source of sediment came from. And what they found from that study was that there's really three primary sources of sediment in the Root River watershed. It's agricultural fields. It's what we call stream bank erosion or near channel type of erosion. And then soil that's coming from hill slopes, primarily what we kind of call like these forested hill slopes or ravines that we tend to see along these steep valleys in the Root River watershed. And so what they did is they looked at the total load of sediment coming out of the Root River at Mound Prairie.
Can you define what load is?
Yeah, so the load is the total amount of sediment expressed in pounds or tons. That's measured at the outlet of the watershed. And they do that by measuring the total volume of water. And if they know the concentration of that water, the sediment, the amount of suspended sediment in the water, we can estimate the total volume or the total mass of sediment that's coming out of the watershed. And the Pollution Control Agency has data going back several years now, going back to, I think, 2008, where they've been measuring that at the outlet. And so they looked at a study period, I think, between about 2009 through about 2015 or 16. They looked at the total mass coming out of the watershed, and they estimated that of that total volume or mass of sediment coming out of the watershed, they estimated that about roughly 40% of that was coming from agricultural sources. And they can't tell whether or not that sediment came from yesterday or a week before, but it's sort of they estimate that it's probably within the last probably 2 to 3 decades is when most of that field source of sediment was the source of that sediment.
So basically 90s and later is mostly what we're talking.
Right, okay. Right. And then, but what was interesting is they found that another roughly 40% was coming from what they call near channel sources of sediment. And so this is sediment that what we typically call like stream bank erosion. When you're driving along Highway 16 and you're driving along the Root River there, and you see a lot of those exposed stream banks, that's where what they estimate that source to be coming from is about 40% of the total load coming from stream bank erosion. And then the last component they found was that was roughly around, I think around 10 to 13% was coming from what they estimate coming from bluffland or forested ravines and in hill slopes. And so that total amount doesn't really total up to 100%. And some of that is because some of that sediment is also getting stored within the floodplain of the Root River also. But the other really, I think, interesting thing that they found is that with that, most of that sediment occurring or a significant amount coming from the stream banks is that they found that likely a lot of that sediment was actually originally from the upland cultivated areas, but likely was transported and deposited within the floodplain of the Root River over the past 150 years, or roughly during the time period of when the area was settled. And so a lot of that erosion, like you were mentioning earlier on, that occurred in the early 1900s, a lot of that sediment worked its way off of the fields and worked its way slowly down into the floodplains of the Root River. And so in a way now, that sediment is now getting reworked and working its way out of the system. And so it's sort of a legacy effect of that sediment that originally was in our upland fields, but is now being deposited and stored and now getting reworked and making its way out. So sort of the kind of the bigger, I guess, implication of that study is that it sort of indicates that, yes, stream bank erosion is a significant source as well as field sources. But for us, at least in the near term, to measure any significant effects of improvement as a result of targeted conservation practices within the entire Root River watershed, it may be difficult to measure that in the near term because of this masking effect of this this legacy sediment that is still within the system and still needs to kind of get worked out. And until that happens, which could take several decades and even much, much longer, we're likely to see a masking effect of some of the practices that we're doing. But I tell our farmers and landowners not to get discouraged by that. But I think it's really important that the public and others understand that you know, these what's happening at the watershed scale, especially at the scale of the Root River watershed, is pretty complex. And to sort of gauge our expectations about water quality and to also be understanding that there's other sources of sediment that are coming into the system. And
and that's especially at the big scale.
At the big scale, exactly. Yeah. But the flip side to that is sort of the kind of the twist to that is that as you work your way up into these smaller tributaries to the Root River, let's say Willow Creek, or let's say the North Branch of the Root River, or things like that, these smaller scales where we're working at maybe 100,000 acre or less scales, that kind of it flip flops. So instead of being roughly 60% non-field source and 40% field source, it flip flops to about 40%. Or less non-field source and 60% field source or more. And that's just simply the result of, as you work your way up in the system, you have more connection to the fields and less sources of that near channel types of erosion within those systems.
So that's a really important point to me, because if you wanted to say, grade us and how we're improving water quality over time, or just grade us on how well conservation practices are working, you really shouldn't be looking at what's happening so much in the Root River, like down by Rushford. It's really looking at these small scales, these small streams that you're monitoring at that level, because that's where changes happen pretty quickly, Whereas the Root, we're going to be dealing with the effects of this legacy effect for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it highlights the challenge of trying to quantify the benefits of some of these practices. Don't get discouraged that, yes, as you work your way up, I think there's much better opportunity to do that. And I think even at the big scale, at the big watershed scale, I think for us to not forget about some of these other non-quantitative methods of measuring improvement over time. And I think that's, how many of these critical source areas or femoral gullies or other areas on the landscape within these watersheds, how many of those have gotten dressed? How many more acres of pollinator habitat, or more acres of grass waterway or terraces. I think those are other surrogates that I think could be used.
So at that large scale, it's more, at the small scale, you can focus more on results. At the large scale, you have to have some faith in practices that you know will eventually make results and really focus on the practices themselves.
Yeah, I agree. And I think I think that's what is unique about the Field to Stream partnership is that, you know, we do have these really small scaled watersheds that, you know, we're hoping that we'll be able to really quantify that signal as a result of these, some of these targeted practices at that scale.
Yeah. There's a phrase that always has stuck with me. I mean, I know, you know, Stanley Trimble, who, you know, did a lot of the work on soil erosion in this area, and he wrote a book about it. And a phrase he used, he calls it this area, a region trapped in its own history, which I really love that phrase. And I think what he means is when you look out at what you see today in terms of the landscape, you know, the kind of undercut stream banks and all of these things, and also the processes that are occurring in terms of sediment working its way and kind of turbidity, like you said, in the root river, you know, that is at least partly defined by things that happened 50, 100 years ago. And I just think that's a really interesting message or interesting point for this area. Forgive me if we did touch on this, but how does that amount of soil and phosphorus compare between the main body of the root river and the smaller scales, you know, the small streams and the edge of field?
Yeah, so again, at that small watershed scale, we measure anywhere between about 250 to about 500 pounds per acre per year soil loss. And when we look at the data from the Pollution Control Agency at the outlet of the Root River at Mound Prairie, we find it's about the same. It's about 500 pounds per acre. So it doesn't really change all that much compared to what we see at the small watershed scale. And that was something that the lead researcher, Patrick Belmont, was just really amazed by, and it just, I think it reiterated another line of evidence in his mind that there's other sources of sediment coming into the system. Because normally, again, as you work up in scale, we would normally expect those sediment losses to be reduced even further, but we're not
seeing it. On a per acre basis.
On a per acre basis.
Yeah. Yep. Okay.
Yep.
Any other last comments or thoughts about the legacy sediment?
You know, one thing we don't really know a lot about as it relates to nutrients is how much of that phosphorus that is contained or associated with stream bank erosion, how much of that phosphorus is associated with that. And I don't know of too many studies that have looked at that, especially in the root. I'm not aware of any that have done that. But that's something that I think is an opportunity for other researchers to look at, is to look at that phosphorus contribution from these stream bank sources as well. Because certainly, again, similar to what we find at the field scale, if we're typically how this phosphorus is transported is with the sediment. And so having a better idea of those levels from the stream banks of phosphorus would be helpful too.
So one last thing. You've been monitoring these watersheds for a while now, you know, almost 10 years, right?
Yep, be a 10th year.
So we've had a pretty pronounced trend in southeast Minnesota recently of having fewer rainstorms. They're kind of shorter, but they're dropping more rain, and they're dropping it more quickly than they used to. Just keeping that in mind, have you seen any trends over time in water quality in these watersheds?
So we're at a point now where I recently looked at that, and we did a trend analysis on the first 8 years during our baseline period. And really the main reason for doing that was to have something to compare to in the next 10 years and to see, if there were any changes as a result of some of the targeted practices that we're working on. But 8 years is probably about the minimum you want to run any type of trend analysis, especially at a watershed scale. And so I don't have a lot of confidence in presenting the data at this point. But what I can say in general is that with sediment and phosphorus, and the reason for that, why I'm not as confident in it, is because, as I mentioned earlier before, it really only takes you know, 1 year can really affect the trend of the data, and because sediment and phosphorus is so variable from year to year. And so if you happen to start on a really kind of a normal year, and on the end you happen to have a really, really wet year, you have a really high sediment loss, so it's going to tell you that, yes, you have an increasing trend for sediment loss. But that may be heavily skewed by one particular year of data. So I think with sediment and phosphorus especially, I'm reluctant on really discerning, or I guess coming up with too many conclusions of that. But I think we need at least probably another 10 to even 15 more years before we can conclusively say, yes, this is kind of the trend that we're seeing for sediment and phosphorus. Now, on the other hand, for dissolved nutrients like nitrate, I do feel more confident in that. And that's something, you know, perhaps we can talk a little bit more at our next.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in future podcasts for sure. That's a whole story in and of itself. You have any other concluding thoughts about this? You know, the discussion of how nutrients move from the field scale to the river system and downstream.
Well, I think the very positive message I want to get across is that we have this reduction of sediment and phosphorus from the field to the watershed scale. And that's a very positive story. And I think we have to give credit to a lot of the practices that farmers are using and have used over the last, several decades. But with that said, I think there's still, even at that watershed scale, we still have some goals to try to obtain, especially with regard to phosphorus at the watershed scale and throughout the entire state of Minnesota as it leaves our state and goes into the Mississippi and eventually gets into the Gulf of Mexico, is we have a nutrient reduction strategy. And right now, our interim goal for that statewide is about a 12% reduction for the Mississippi River Basin of phosphorus. And so that still will require some additional practices at the small watershed scale and bigger watershed scale to try to achieve that sediment reduction. And again, though, if we can, you get two for one type of thing. If you can control your soil loss and target that, we can have our nitrogen and most of our phosphorus come along with that. So I think, what we need to continue to think about in these watersheds is resilience, especially with changes in climate and more precipitation. Going back 50 years ago, our average annual precip in this area was a little more than 30 inches, and now we're almost, 36, 37, even more than that.
Yeah.
And 2018, we had over 60 inches recorded in the town of Harmony. So how do we deal with that more precipitation? And I think, minimum tillage operations, no-till operations, cover crops, anything that we can do to have more of that water soak into the ground rather than run off. I think also there's more opportunities in these watersheds to maintain what we already have for practices. And then also new practices, especially, small little detention bases that can, temporarily store water for maybe 24 hours at a time and then slowly release it. And we've been seeing more farmers look at that as a practice on their farm. Not necessarily full-blown terraces on their farms, but just these little, little ridges that they put in their fields are called kind of farmable terraces in a way that allows for a temporary trapping of sediment and also, more opportunities to infiltrate that water and slow it up. As one of my farmer leaders likes to put it, let's see what we can do to make the water walk instead of run.
I like that. Great, thanks. So I was thinking about this a lot too, just this data and what it means. So this spring I was on a flight back to Minnesota, and I flew over the Bluff Country on the way, which, by the way, just to plug that is such a great way to experience this area because the landscape is so unique and you can really see it from the air. So looking out the window from the plane, I was really struck how that alternating pattern of forest and cropland that you see on the hillsides and on the valley floors and on top of the hills, it really reminded me, I don't know if you remember from like biology class seeing those diagrams or pictures of like blood vessels or capillaries. It just looks like that. It's such an interesting landscape. And you get these, especially in the eastern part of the watershed, you get all these and the karst areas, all these contour strips across the fields, you know. When I was flying over them, it was this dark green of alfalfa against the, you know, light tan of corn residue or brown of tilled earth. And it really, maybe because I was hungry, it really reminded me of that old-fashioned, like, ribbon candy, you know. It's got the alternating patterns in it. Anyways, that's just a long way of saying, you know, those patterns on the landscape, they were put in place to keep the soil in place, really. And they really make this place unique. I would charge anyone to try and find a place that looks like this driftless or bluff area anywhere else. And I think those are, even beyond their value in holding soil back, they're worth celebrating just for that uniqueness, you know, in this area. Also, I think it's worth zooming out a bit when we talk about the water quality data and remembering that we're looking at a point in time that's kind of along a trajectory, you know. So compared to the catastrophic soil erosion early 1900s, depending on the estimates you see, you know, or who's done the measuring, you see we've cut soil erosion probably about 75% in the region. It's pretty significant. And then if you look at how much soil is actually washing into our stream valleys, it's like 10 times more than when before Europeans got here to this part of the United States. But it's also only about 3% of what was happening during those really bad years, like the 30s and 40s. So the question is always, are we doing good or bad, you know? And maybe the answer is really both. But I think the other thing I think about a lot is that, you know, what got this region out of those really bad soil erosion days of the 30s and 40s was a combination of scientific research to understand what could halt that soil erosion process. But it also took farmers experimenting with new techniques and working things like contour strips or plowing along the contours, terraces, grass waterways, working those into their actual farm operations. And all of that process was really necessary for that soil erosion to be halted. And the thing I just keep thinking about is, it's really that same spirit of innovation and collaboration that's going to be responsible for continuing to push us in that right direction when it comes to soil and nutrient losses in southeast Minnesota.
All right, well, that about does it for this two-part special episode. If you haven't already, check out the links and information about the Root River Watershed and Field to Stream Partnership, as well as other subjects discussed today that we included in this episode's Minnesota Crop News blog post. We'd like to thank the Minnesota Agricultural Fertilizer Research and Education Council, AFRAC, for supporting this podcast. Thanks for listening.